This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. You know, a stroll through the hushed halls of an art gallery is not everyone's idea of fun. But a new podcast by a longtime art curator is looking to bridge the gap between visual art aficionados and everyone else. Jennifer Dassel is the Associate Curator of Contemporary Art at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh. She is the creator of the new Art Curious podcast, and Jennifer joins me now in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us more about the unexpected, the slightly odd, and the strangely wonderful in art. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. Basically, I started this podcast only last summer, so I'm only about 14 or 15 episodes in at this point. But I came up with the idea to have this podcast because I essentially run into two types of people. The first are people who say, oh, I love art. Art is so great. And the other half the people are the ones who say, oh, art is so boring and I can't get behind it the way I can get into film or dance or music, something with movement and action. And I always thought that was a shame because art has just as many fascinating stories to tell. So my podcast is a way to fight against that a little bit.
But you realize that it's the story that once people get into the story, then they'll have a different view of the art.
Exactly. At least that is always my hope, just as a nice entree into the art world.
And part of this is that the story is not just about the place in art history, kind of how art had evolved, but some of the particular stories behind particular works, right?
Exactly. And my goal is always to tell the ones that are just a little slightly offbeat. There are already some wonderful art podcasts out there that give you some information more specific to types of art, works, periods in art that are more kind of art historical, lecture-y in nature. And this was my way of giving you a narrative, something fun, and even sometimes something kind of funky.
Funky, mysterious, conspiracy theories make up a good part of this. Tell us about that. I think maybe talking a little bit about the Mona Lisa and stories about its authenticity.
Yes.
Something you tackled.
That was actually the very first episode that I did, and it actually has a long history with me. When I was in college, back in my undergraduate at University of California, Davis, I had this wonderful professor who was completely smart, logical, straightforward, somebody who I very much trusted and respected her opinion. And one day in the middle of lecture class, she basically stood up and said, well, but the Mona Lisa in view at the Louvre is fake. It's a forgery. And I thought that was just such a strange statement. And it just seemed a little too conspiracy theory for me. But I've always held on to that. And so my first episode was me kind of exploring this, learning about the Mona Lisa being stolen not once, but possibly twice, possibly by art forgers, and kind of going into that history about what makes the Mona Lisa so fantastic.
That alone would be enough to, you know, if you didn't know much about it, the fact that it's been stolen once, and you say possibly twice, which is another conspiracy theory. I mean, was it stolen or was it not? All of this. And the idea of a forgery, once that gets in our head, we're thinking, you know, I don't think I'd know the real Mona Lisa if I saw it, so why not, right?
Exactly. And there's always been this thought that, well, if you have something that's so iconic and so classic and so amazing on view, you're going to do whatever you can to protect it, so why not possibly have a forgery on view? You never know.
And what would that mean for all of us as those of us who have lined up and seen the work itself? And, of course, it also leads to the fact that it has not only been stolen but also attacked has meant that it has to be protected in ways that, you know, artists and art lovers sometimes complain about.
Exactly. I did an episode just probably a couple months back about specifically this idea of art attacks and just the idea of what makes somebody physically wield a weapon against not a person but an inanimate object brings up all these questions about power in art. What is it representing to us? What kind of control does it have over us? And it's different for every person, but it sure has some really strong reactions.
Well, tell us about that because it also points to an actual psychiatric condition, right?
Yes, it's called Stendhal syndrome. And it was originally coined in Florence after a doctor noticed that she kept having all of these tourists coming in after visiting the Uffizi Museum and different galleries in Florence and feeling like they felt dizzy or ill or undone somehow. So she was the first one to actually claim this syndrome as a viable problem.
And tell us about it. I mean, what is the syndrome and kind of how does it work?
Yeah. So it's based after the French writer Stendhal in the 19th century, who basically wrote the first description about feeling overcome by looking at a work of art or multiple works of art. Something that's too beautiful or too intense brings up emotions that are just so much that they can't actually be processed. And so this comes off as looking either like you're having some sort of minor dizziness problem, or you can have a major dissociative state. So it's really anywhere from being a very mild condition to a very strong actual psychosis.
And does this, I'm very curious about this, and you've done the research, so I'm going to ask you a little more. Is it only for works of art, that is human artifacts, or can this happen in nature as well?
You know, that I think that can definitely happen in nature as well. I think it's the idea of the beautiful or the sublime, something that's too big for us to appreciate. So even though this syndrome is specifically art-related, I think it can apply to pretty much anything.
But it raises the question, and I think apropos of what you do, not only as a podcaster, but as a curator, of the power of cultural expectation. In other words, art within a cultural milieu and how it might be perceived as beautiful, not so much to somebody outside of that culture, and to what extent art does reflect kind of who we are as people and who we are as what we are as a culture.
Absolutely. I think it's very telling that this idea of Stendhal syndrome started in Florence and that the doctor who diagnosed it originally was saying that she was seeing it amongst tourists, not amongst Italians or people who were living in Florence. So I definitely agree with you.
What about the some of the things you've come across now? You know, once you commit to a podcast, that those episodes are, you know, staring you in the face and those deadlines are staring you in the face. Where do you come up with your ideas?
Oh, that's such a good question. I have a long running list of topics and things that I would love to cover. But I also have some wonderful listeners who write in either to Twitter or to Facebook or also just to my direct website, and they say, ooh, I have a great idea for you. So it's really a little bit across the board in that way.
Do you know if these are coming from art lovers or sort of casual art observers?
Both. That's the nice thing. I really just started this because I wanted to have people like art or be interested in art in a new way. And for me, having somebody who comes to me and say, I didn't know anything about art, I don't like art very much, but now you've allowed me to think about it, and I'm going to go home and watch a movie about Frida Kahlo with my wife. That's a big deal to me. That is humbling and so exciting.
Now, you launched the podcast over the summer, and I wonder what kind of reception you got to that first episode.
The first episode, I think, was one of our most popular and still is to this day. I think that conspiracy theory aspect really plays up in it. It's been really great. I basically hoped that I would get maybe 100 people who weren't related to me in any sort of way listening. And the fact that I can claim a few thousand at this point is just more than I could have ever hoped for.
How does it lead? I mean, let's talk about the Mona Lisa, for instance. Okay, whether or not the one that's hanging on the wall in the Louvre is actually the real deal. It's a great story. It's a great detective story. Can you then kind of weave in some of the details about that moment in history and what makes that painting worth stealing and worth, you know, hanging a fake on the wall?
Absolutely. And that is hopefully the point of doing the podcast, is I want to give you that fun story and that little bit of a conspiracy, but I also want to teach you a little bit about some of the relevant ideas about art history, what makes a painting interesting as opposed to a sculpture, or why a photograph is taken in a certain way.
What about, I can't let you go without getting your take on whether or not it's a fake, Mona Lisa. What do you think?
I think that it's not. I think it has so much cultural importance that to put something like that away and hide it and not allow people to see it, I think that's just not as important.
No. See, here's what happened. Here's what happened. They stole it. And the museum couldn't admit it. And so they hung the fake. They've always had the fake.
Right.
This is my story. This is my theory now. And they've always had it. And because, you know, what if? And it goes and they hang it on the wall and say, we got it back. We got it back. So they didn't do that because to protect the real one, they actually lost the real one forever and can't admit it.
I think that is entirely possible. And that is one of the theories.
Would we know that? I mean, again, this gets to most of us would walk past that and there's no way on earth I could tell you. But there are people who know. Are you confident enough that art historians today and the the people who specialize in this could tell you that?
Well, here's the problem. The problem is that they keep you at such a distance that even most art historians and collectors and connoisseurs and conservators can't even have access to the real painting. It's only by very special appointment. And even conservators who've come in to want to take a look at the Mona Lisa, unless they work directly with the Louvre, aren't even allowed to make an appointment to do so.
Yeah, but let's say I hire Geraldo Rivera to do a special on whether it's a fake, and he gets permission to go in, and maybe he, if it's Geraldo, he'll do it himself. But I'm saying he, you know, what you do is you'd hire a pro. Is there anybody with the competence now, and what would be the means of testing whether or not it's the real deal?
Certainly, you can test the wood in the panel. It's painted on panel instead of canvas, so you can do scientific explorations like that. But you also have Leonardo specialists who would hopefully be able to look at things like the brush stroke or X-ray technology or infrared technology to see what was underneath it to find out what it was made on and if it matches other works by Leonardo. But as far as finding the actual specifics, it really can be anybody's guess.
And if you think about all the people who have traipsed past there and then told everybody they saw it, they actually don't want to know the answer if in fact it's a phony. It's like, don't tell me.
Exactly.
Because my bragging rights just, I lost like 30 points on all of that. talk more about these attacks too. There's a psychiatric condition, but there's also a chain of events, I guess, when a work of art is attacked, right?
It's true. You know, one of the things that I think is very interesting is that these kind of attacks happen all the time. And sometimes it can be very small, like a teenager putting a piece of gum onto a canvas. But the reason that we don't hear about it as much is because museums and galleries want to keep it under wraps. We don't want to go and tell people that there was a problem or there was some sort of issue at a museum. You want to keep it really quiet. And part of that's just because you don't want to call attention to it, but also because there's always the idea of copycats, just like there is with any other crime.
Another theory that you delve into is the connection between the CIA and modern art. Tell us more.
Yeah, this was a story that was completely new to me until I started researching it. It's the idea that during the Cold War, the CIA actually used modern art as a type of weapon against the Soviet Union to promote the USA's cultural superiority. So whereas the Soviet Union had these very strict guidelines as to what artists should paint and how they should paint, the US at the time was very free and allowed artists to really do whatever they wanted to. There was no strict deadlines and guidelines. And so the CIA secretly funneled money towards artists, specifically abstract expressionist artists like Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, and allowed them to continue to create works. And then they were touring them as part of these large-scale exhibitions throughout Europe.
And the CIA had to be circumspect in the way it funneled this money, right?
Exactly. They had what was called a long leash policy. And so it kept the artists and their work at a remove of 2 to 3 spaces from the actual CIA and their funding. So it was very much undercover. And I don't think it was until the 80s or 90s that it was actually confirmed that this was something that really happened.
All right, so the CIA has promoted modern art, and we have them to thank for that, for funding it in this country. And, of course, it was all part of that cultural, a larger cultural project that also promoted jazz and other things in the Soviet world. So tell us more about your own research and your specialty. What is it that that excited you and got you into the business of art history?
I started in art history, when I was a freshman in college, and that really was a random thing. I took an art history class, just a basic survey, and ended up completely loving it. And so I became an art history major and studied it all the way through. I have my master's in art history, some PhD coursework in art history, and then now I work as a curator of contemporary art at the NCMA.
What is it we should know? I think one of the fascinating things for me, I mean, I at one time in my life found myself in that second group of people you know who just couldn't get into visual art until I started making connections, or good professors started making connections for me between trends in art, changes in the way art would appear, and historical and political changes that were going on. And once I could see that, oh yeah, if you start feeling a little bit, you know, discombobulated in terms of your consciousness, and we've got writers writing about this disassociation, might be about time for paintings not to look as connected and contiguous. And so we see Picasso. And once I started to understand that, I got interested in art. So that's a different kind of a story. It's not the story of the painting, but it's the story of the painting's place in cultural history.
Absolutely. I keep thinking about the fact that what's happening in art, in the art world in general right now, is the same, I think, that's happening in film and in music and really our society in general, which is opening it up to inclusion and diversity. And that's something that I hope is happening in art history as well, not just in contemporary art, and that we are trying to go back and look at artists who have been overlooked at this point, women in particular, artists of different races and backgrounds, even different religions. And I think that's something that's been filtering in for the last couple decades.
Women in art brings us to the story of Marie Antoinette.
Yes, exactly. This was a very fun story. There's an artist in particular who ended up being her specific portraitist, and her name was Elizabeth Vigée Le Brun. And I thought that it was totally incredible that a woman in the late 18th century would end up rising in the ranks to becoming the most incredible and most important painter to the Queen of France. You would think that usually the Queen or the royal circles would have their own painters who they would commission and require. And for the vast majority, that would be a man, because the men had access and had the abilities to learn about being a painter, whereas women at the time were fairly uneducated. So the fact that a woman was able to claim that position is pretty incredible.
Women were, particularly aristocratic women, were trained in the arts, though. They could certainly play music. They could write. Why was it that we don't see women represented in the visual arts as well? Obviously, this is a part of a patriarchy, but it seemed to be an area that was in some ways more open to women.
Yes. I think it's very interesting what women were taught, it seems to be, in the late 18th century and the early 19th century, is learning things like music and poetry and dance and visual art to a degree was mainly just because those were the things that they were considered important for snagging a husband. Mm. So it would be very surface level, I believe. So the artists who would do more than just drawing or sketching or even using pastels, those would be the artists who really struggled to find their place in society, because art, even back then, was really considered a man's world.
So you had to have a patron, and you were not going to be patronized if you weren't part of the patriarchy, I guess.
Exactly. And you also had to hopefully have somebody who could help you, who was a man already. Like in the case of Elizabeth Vigée Le Brun, her father was a painter, and so he was able to give her and teach her the ropes a little bit. She probably would not have been a painter if it hadn't had that personal connection.
What else do we know about her?
She really started at a very young age learning how to draw from her father. And then it was when she was a teenager that she started becoming more well-known and more famous, and members of the aristocracy actually started hiring her as a portraitist. She was very successful at it, and that she was much, I would say, a little bit of a flatterer. So she was able to paint somebody so that they looked probably even better than they did in real life, and that made her extremely popular.
And so what, and were there women who were maybe working with under men's names? Would that be something they would do?
Definitely. You know? Just like with Georges Sand, who was the writer who was working under a French pseudonym, there were also women who were even going under disguise as being a man. One of my favorite painters that I'm hoping to cover at a future episode is a painter named Rosa Bonheur, who was also a French painter in the mid-19th century, and she wore men's clothes. She cut her hair very short. She was probably a lesbian. But at the time, that was completely scandalous for her to say, I'm going to go around Paris, and I'm not going to wear a skirt. I'm going to wear pants.
And what about Marie Antoinette's? We talked about her artist, her portrait artist. Did she go on? Well, first of all, did she keep her head?
She did.
So she survived the whole thing and got to keep the cake, I assume. But did she go on in her career?
She did. I think she was actually incredible in that she was able to make it out of France alive during the revolution, and to be connected to the Queen so closely like that and make it out alive is pretty amazing. And she went on to have an incredible career. She moved out of France and moved onwards through Europe, eventually settling for a while in Russia and painting for some of the people in St. Petersburg as well.
Okay, so what's the big surprise? What's the podcast coming up that we just can't miss?
Let's see. The next one is coming up as a follow-up of the Art of Attack episode that I did earlier in the season here, that's about a man named Hans Bullmann, who was a serial art vandal. So he actually ruined and destroyed a number of works of art, over 40 pieces.
Wow. You will hear more about him in Art Curious, which is the creation of Jennifer Dassel. She created that podcast. She is also Associate Curator of Contemporary Art at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
We've got links to Art Curious podcast at our website, stateofthings.org. You can also download the podcast through Stitcher or through iTunes. And we have more of the State of Things just ahead.